This is NPR's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Each Monday, we feature a story from the NPR 100, our list of the 100 most significant pieces of American music from the century just past.
Crazy.
Excuse me. I got plenty of
rhythm. I got
my land.
And you may ask yourself,
how does it feel?
Lovely, lovely.
Today on our NPR 100 series, we feature a work that musicians and critics alike considered to be a masterpiece of minimalism, Drumming by Steve Reich. Minimalism flourished in symphonic music in the 1960s and 70s. Composers like Steve Reich broke down music to its most elemental forms, a single chord, even a single tone or a simple pulse. Then they would weave those elements back together to create a new musical structure, often using the same motif over and over again. Mark Mobley is a music producer for NPR's Performance Today and a percussionist. He spoke to Steve Reich and prepared this report.
Think about a piece of music as a painting. Let's say a melody is like a tree at the center of the canvas, and the harmonies are the surrounding sunset. But what if you wanted to paint a different kind of picture, a maze of patterns that interlock at countless angles? It might sound something like this. This is Drumming by Steve Reich. This 1971 piece is one of the touchstones of late 20th century music and a turning point in Reich's career. It is scored solely for keyboard percussion instruments, voices, piccolo, and bongos. As modern as this music may seem, it was made by good old-fashioned American tinkering. Reich, who's now in his early 60s, grew up in New York and L.A. His musical upbringing was standard issue for the years after World War II. He listened to what he calls the middle-class favorites, Beethoven, Schubert, some Wagner. He studied military-style drumming with a member of the New York Philharmonic. And at 14, he was blindsided by three things that would change his life: The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, and bebop. Young Steve formed his own jazz band, and he fell in love with the playing of Kenny Clarke, founding drummer of the Modern Jazz Quartet.
Kenny Clarke was not the virtuoso that Max Roach was and is, but what Kenny Clarke had that no one else seems to have had is a kind of magic buoyancy, I think is the only way I could describe it. It's just the entire band would float on the quality of his time, and the playing was mostly just on the way he played the ride cymbal with occasional accents on the bass drum. And that sort of magic quality of time became kind of ideal, and almost everything that I write has a fixed tempo, and it has a, you know, you can tap your foot to it. And undoubtedly, this was rooted in that attraction to Kenny Clarke and jazz in general.
Reich gave up his own jazz gigging after college when he began graduate composition studies. At the time, after-hours swinging didn't seem like a dignified thing for a Juilliard student to do. He later moved on to Mills College in California, and his pedigree is impeccable. He studied with some of the titans of 20th century composition. And as many other musicians did in the 60s, he formed an improv group. His partners included Grateful Dead bassist Phil Lesh. But the key to Steve Reich's future wasn't in the classroom or on the corner of Haight and Ashbury. It was on quarter-inch tape. Reich had begun to experiment with a reel-to-reel tape machine, making pieces out of, among other things, conversations he surreptitiously taped in the taxi he drove to support himself. Once, while experimenting with two tape recorders, he discovered he could create a hypnotic effect. Just by playing two copies of the same thing simultaneously and gradually speeding up one to throw it out of sync, like an echo. That's how he made one of his earliest masterpieces, a 1966 composition called Come Out. The voice here is that of a black victim of police brutality in New York.
I had to, like, open the bruise up and let some of the bruised blood come out to show them.
By slowly, slowly speeding up one of the machines, Reich gets a ricochet effect. Reich told an interviewer once that when he discovered this effect, it was like hearing a sound crawl down one side of his body and back up the other. But the tape pieces were a sort of dead end. He wanted to create this effect of shifting pulses with live musicians. Reich found his new path when a lecturer mentioned a book about African music. When Reich opened it and saw the musical scores, it was a bit like stumbling on a map of his own mind. The music of tribal drummers was made of patterns, overlapping patterns. And in 1970, just as his tape pieces and austere instrumental music were starting to win him bookings and good reviews, he left to study African drumming at the University of Ghana in Accra.
What going to Africa did was like a huge pat on the back, a huge confirmation, a huge green light, saying basically, yes, acoustical instruments, especially percussion, are very rich in sound, even richer than the electronics that Stockhausen and Cage are working with. Yes, percussion can become the dominant voice in chamber or symphonic music, if you like. Go ahead, do it. And that really was the force behind writing drumming.
After just 5 weeks, his trip cut short by a bout of malaria, he came back to New York and got to work on what would become drumming. Finishing it took a year.
It was write some, rehearse some, and finally perform some. And there were some private performances in lofts before we actually did the world premiere.
That world premiere at the Museum of Modern Art lasted an hour and a half and earned not just a standing ovation, but positive reviews. At least one critic has called it minimalism's first masterpiece. But while audiences enjoyed hearing drumming, some listeners took a little pity on the players. Bob Becker is a member of the virtuoso percussion group Nexus. Becker joined Steve Reich and musicians in 1973, and he has played drumming hundreds of times. He's one of the players you've heard here in a recording made as part of a 10-CD Reich retrospective released in 1997.
The comment that we heard a lot in the 70s about that music as a criticism was often, gosh, you guys must just feel like machines playing that music. It's so strict, it's so repetitive that it must be almost mechanical. And it was always surprising to me to hear that comment, but when I thought about it, you know, I could understand that an observer might feel that, we might feel that way. But in Steve's music, there's quite a bit of musicality that is allowed and, in fact, desired.
After the opening 15 minutes of bongo patterns, the music shifts to a group of three marimbas and, for the first time in Reich's music, live singing voices. Reich says he got the idea to use voices as he worked with his marimba and a tape recorder.
And I would play the patterns on the marimbas and record them and play against them on the marimba against the tape. And when you've got two of these patterns going on a marimba is a very rich instrument with a long decay. The note rings out for a while. There's a large resonator under the wooden bars. It's a mellifluous version of the xylophone, which is much higher, sharper, and shorter. And when I heard these marimba patterns sort of floating in the room, I began to hear women singing. And I thought to myself, you know, am I just, you know, what's happening to me? Am I hallucinating here? And I thought, well, what if there really was a woman singing and actually singing some of these patterns that I hear that are basically the acoustical, they are the result of the same pattern being played against itself. And when you write it out on music paper and you sort of, as it were, add up the notes to see what's going on at each moment, you see that there are lots and lots and lots of little sub-patterns that are actually, you know, really there. So the voice is used to imitate the sound of the instrument, which... It really comes out sounding, you know, sounds to me, you know, basically it probably grew out of listening to Ella Fitzgerald do scat singing when I was growing up and listening to her singing very, very often.
piece is all treble, no bass. After the marimba section, the music heads even further upward into music for three glockenspiels, or sets of bells. Whistling by the composer himself on this recording and piccolo fill out the texture. In the final climactic portion of the piece, all the musicians join forces.
Pitch-wise and timbre-wise, it gets most interesting in the fourth section. And that's when I think, you know, when I'm enjoying it most is the very, very last protracted section in drumming at the end of the piece when the singers are singing and the piccolo is playing and we're the entire, you know, group of three glockenspiels and three drummers and three marimba players are all, you know, going at it simultaneously.
Percussionists and fellow composers aren't the only musicians to have been inspired by Reich's ecstatic manipulation of patterns. In 1999, Nonesuch Records released a collection of techno-style versions of his music. It's called Reich Remixed, and it includes this take on drumming by Curtis Mantronic, which brings the process full circle. Music inspired by tape loops becomes the subject of a new tape piece. But the enduring appeal of drumming isn't the way it's made, it's the way it sounds. Percussionist Bob Becker.
It's like looking at a very finely, perfectly cut gem. It doesn't change, but as you turn it in the light, you reflect hundreds of different colors and intensities of light. In drumming and in African drumming, this effect is very pronounced and it's very exciting and beautiful when you become aware of it.
Does it swing?
Well, if it's played correctly, it's got to, or you're dead in the water. I mean, the piece is definitely built to do that, yeah.
For NPR News in Washington, I'm Mark Mobley.